Welcome to Fresno's Best Podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Molly DeFrank on the show. Molly worked in politics before taking on the important role of stay-at-home mom. She has channeled her time in that role and experiences into two books. First, Digital Detox, about navigating the worlds of parenting and technology, and her most recent book, and the subject of today's conversation, Mothering Boys, which explores the complicated world of raising boys in the 21st century. Molly was a joy to talk to, and even if you aren't a parent but just have children in your life, you will find something interesting and insightful to take from this conversation. Let's go meet Molly, and Baker will take us there.
Blessed to infiltrate the pod waves on infinite quests, investigating, making convos to elevate guests. Politics, religion, culture, art, music, show some respect to the best little city left in the U.S. Fresno's best! Fresno's best!
Molly, where do you like to eat in Fresno?
Oh, there are so many good spots, especially over the last 5 or 10 years that have popped up. Other Side is incredible.
Yep. I went there for the first time. I was like, finally a place where I can spend $27 on a coffee and a muffin. I've been waiting for
What'd you get?
I got some kind of pastry that had some kind of fruit in it. And then I'm an oat milk cortado type.
That sounds fancy. That sounds great.
Yeah. What'd you get when you went?
Okay, so I went once for breakfast. I got the spicy egg sandwich. It was phenomenal. And then I split two different bowls the next time I went for lunch with a friend. I got like a shaken iced tea. It was so good. I can't wait to go back. It was delish. Annex is another spot. Mm-hmm. Can't get enough.
Yeah. I have similar spots. How was lunch at the Other Side? I was hoping lunch would be good because then it could be like a place on rotation at different times of the day.
Put it on rotation. It's great. Okay. We had a salmon bowl. And a chicken bowl. It was like healthy and delicious. Oh, yeah, God. I can't wait to go back. It was really good.
That's what I miss now that I live here. I'm from Southern California. Like all the high-end salad places that I miss being able to go to. Salad-ish, your Tender Greens, all those types of places. And we have some things here, but not a ton in that range where you're just like, I want a healthy protein, veggie, complex carb lunch. And where do I go to get that exactly?
Exactly. Heirloom, too. They're beet salad is super good. You add a little protein on there. Makes a good meal.
Absolutely.
A lot of good spots.
I'm excited to talk to you. There's so many things that I want to go through, but I want to start with a few biographical questions. What do you think you learned about communication in your time in government, working in politics? Is there things that stuck with you from that time that still come to mind or methods or modus operandi today for you?
Yeah, that was a really fun season because I learned, and challenging, I learned from the best and the brightest. The people that work for the governor are at the top of their game. And so I was really just learning from my boss and those people around me. So yeah, I learned to just full effort. I learned to be kind to everyone you work with. That was one of my boss. I remember she took all the younger women out to lunch and she said, be nice to everybody, be pleasant to work with. And I thought that was very interesting because she wasn't imparting this high level communication stuff. She was saying, be a decent human being because that's the right thing to do. But also she's saying it'll come back to bite you if you never knew who you're going to be working for a season later, which I thought that was really interesting. But yeah, these people at the top of their game are just, they're really smart and they're really diligent workers. And clarity is king. I learned that too, especially in writing and communication. So I'm really grateful for that season for sure.
I run into and interact with a lot of politicians in this podcast and others, and it seems like they're always on the edge of overload or overwhelm. Did you take away anything about how people thrive in that space and don't allow it to destroy their personal lives, all the things that kind of come with politics?
Honestly, I think people who are rooted in faith and family tend to be healthier. I think when your job is everything, it's such shaky ground. But I think if you have the job is great, I love it, I'm passionate about it, when you have that mindset. But at the end of the day, when I look back on my deathbed, I'm not going to be wishing I spent more time at the office. I'm going to be grateful that I was working so that I could support my family and invest in my family. I think those are the healthiest people that I've seen.
So you felt drawn back to the political space, though, in terms of a school board race. What was the motivation behind that? And given what you're describing right now of not wanting to, looking back on your deathbed, not wanting to be the office, but you would be okay with being in the school board room if you look back on your deathbed?
It always seemed a little odd to me that the school board was considered political because to me, it's about values and it's about I'm a mom to six kids. And I took that off ramp from a career to full, stay home full time and have a bunch of kids and raise them after my second was born. I did the working mom thing for a while. And we homeschooled for a little while and then put them in our incredible Clovis schools, realizing, gosh, there's so many things that these schools offer. And seeing kind of the way that our state government works at the highest levels and the people who are elected, I'm thinking, gosh, I don't think that necessarily reflects my values or the values of our community. So I saw how important it was for people with values that do represent the community to be in there and having oversight. And yeah. That was my heart motivation. I've got kids. My youngest is in second grade and my oldest is a freshman. And I just care about what books they're reading and I care about the direction and the big picture stuff. So that was my motivation there. It does make me smile that it actually did happen to be a political thing, but yeah, that was why.
I agree with you. If we could depoliticize our school boards, I think it would be better for everyone. And if they weren't looked at as ladders in order to eventually run for city council or whatever, because you see that all the time. Like just Vang, who just got elected in a southern district in Fresno, started out on Sanger School Board. And it's considered a career ladder thing, which, I work in education. That pisses me off because I don't want people in that space that see it as an instrumental thing, because then they're more likely to pour their effort into short-term activities, things that will accrue them some acclaim so they can run for the next office. I hate that's a component of it, but it seems inevitable in some ways. And anyway, we could talk about this forever. I want to jump into the parenting world. So I have a couple questions about parenting influencers. This is such a fascinating world to me, and I'm curious to get your perspective on it, like to see the landscape, if you will. Do you think social media parenting influencers are like a millennial version of Dr. Spock?
I like that. Man, I think I love and hate parenting influencer culture, I think. I actually find social media to be very useful and fun, but also it's a double-edged sword. There's a lot of hard things about it, and I think it can affect everyone differently. There's great advice online, there's horrible advice online. So I think if you can curate the same sort of information or influence that aligns with your values, that's great. But yeah, I think, and I talk about this in my most recent book, there's just a lot of junk out there.
So much fluff. Let me ask you this, because this is something I wonder about. Do you think people go to those influencers, quote unquote, for actual advice, or are they just voyeuristically going to them to see what they picture in their mind's eye of a perfectly maintained and organized and run house? Is it just like parenting porn, or do you think that people are actually looking at it for advice?
I think it's a mixed bag. I think there's a lot of both. And I think, and this goes back to why I don't think young kids should have social media, because adults have fully formed brains, and we hopefully have gone through that period of growing up and understanding, like, gosh, who am I? What do I believe? What's my place in this world? What do I think? And you do that internal work before you have to put on this like outward facing persona of this is who I am. And when I meet people, this is what I tell them I'm about. But I do think that, especially as a culture with so many people spending so much time on social media, we have regressed a little bit in maturity. If you look at the studies, people are growing up, they're becoming adults later, like mentally and spiritually. So I think there can be a lot of immaturity, a lot of the need to outward face and not do that internal work. So I hope my favorite parenting influencers or influencers in general are the ones that share a little bit authentically, but they also are using their gifts and saying, hey, I actually am pretty good at this thing and or making recipes or these cute outfits, but also like I make mistakes too and I blow it in these situations. And I think honestly, the parenting influencers I respect the most are the ones who acknowledge how hard it is and that they blow it sometimes and
Molly,
that their
you
kids aren't perfect.
perfectly anticipated my next question. Like, I was joking recently about the woman that runs the account, Ballerina Farms, because she like manages like a farm. She has a bunch of kids. She has all these businesses, and she doesn't actually like say, "Oh, I'm doing this by myself." But there's a kind of the implication, like that, like she can juggle it all, quote unquote. Whereas we know that's probably an illusion. There's probably like a team of people behind the camera helping her with all the different activities that are on her plate and managing all the people and managing the businesses. And I wonder if that kind of like illusion that's put out there actually does more harm to parents because it makes them feel like they're not enough if they're not doing X, Y, and Z. Do you see that as well?
I could see that. At the same time, I think sometimes those giant platforms that are doing cool things, and I haven't done a deep dive into that one specifically, but sometimes I think they're just highlighting a certain aspect of what they do without maybe giving the whole picture. So maybe some of these accounts I follow, they're just posting great recipes. I love Half Baked Harvest is like a food influencer. I love her. I make all of her recipes, and I'm sure she has a giant team. But I actually, from my perspective, I think it's okay if they're not necessarily, I guess it just depends on as a consumer or as a social media user, what am I coming to these people for? Do I want to be like them or do I want to use this thing that they're creating and appreciate that thing? Or am I looking at them as a person to like, I want to be just like them? I don't know. I guess it depends on how you use social media or how much stock you put in each person and for what purpose. But I do see the sticky trap that you're alluding to at the same time.
Yeah. So you mentioned before that there's a lot of kind of fluff parenting advice. If you could pop two or three bubbles online of stuff that just gets circulated round and round, that would have the biggest impact on either parents' mental health or the kids that are on the receiving end of this advice, what would you pop? What are the balloons you pop?
Oh, that's a great question. I haven't even gotten to ask that one before, but I can, the first one that comes to mind is this whole idea of avoiding prohibitive language to your kids. There's a lot of these accounts that give advice. Oh, instead of saying don't do this or no, say after you do this, then we can do this. That way you're not giving prohibitive language to your kids. And I'm like, what? That's
Yeah,
garbage.
that seems like tough to make boundaries if there isn't any prohibitive
Yeah.
language.
And in the real world, it's okay. Is you want to say, okay, oh, after you can run fast enough as a car, then you can run into the street. No, you're going to hit him with a, hey, don't run in the street. And if you run in the street, there's going to be a consequence. You might die. Like, I have to hold you accountable to these things. So, also, it's such a disservice to kids. Like, when they get into the real world, school, you talk to teachers today, and they're like, gosh, kids, like, they're not listening. They're not respecting authority. So I think it's actually a gift you give your kids when you're teaching them, hey, sometimes you go into the workforce, your boss is going to say, no, I need you to do this, do it now. So I think that's kind of garbage parenting to avoid the no's and the prohibitory words. Let me think a second bubble I would pop. I guess it would just be the idea that you can make things just so as a mom, and then there won't be any struggle.
This
So,
illusion of control.
yeah, and I guess that kind of goes back to the thing you were talking about with social media influencers, where if we take it at face value and just assume that the only things that are real are the things that we see, then we might buy into that lie. I trust that's not the heart of a lot of these influencers. Maybe it is for some of them, but I just would hope that parents know. And I think the key is having real life relationships with other parents in the same seasons. You say, I'm not crazy. It's just hard. Parenting is just hard no matter what. But yeah, the idea that somehow you can do all the right things and your kids will never struggle. And we want our kids to struggle. That's the other thing. That's how
Yeah.
they grow and that's how they learn. I guess those would be the two.
Where are you at in the kind of nature nurture divide? And I would add like a third variable to this, which is like environment, which includes the schools they go to, the kids they associate with. So if you were to like take those as three categories and give them each a percentage as in terms of their impact on who the person becomes as an adult, where would you allocate those? Would you put a lot more to parenting in terms of influence? Would you put a lot more to environment? Like, where are you in those kind of that three category spectrum?
My answer is yes.
Okay.
I guess
Which one do you
all of
think has
them,
outsized
equally.
influence that maybe people underrate as important? Do you think there's more emphasis on parenting has a bigger impact than people expect, or?
I think parenting has a bigger impact than people appreciate.
Yeah.
That said, If I had just, okay, I feel like I can leave it anonymous on which of my kids I'm calling out versus whatever, because I have
There you go.
so
There
many.
you go.
And we've had a lot of like foster kids come in and out of the home. So who knows who I'm talking about? But there's one kid of mine that if I just had that kid, I'd be like, wow, I'm the best parent ever. Look at just why don't parents just do X, Y, and Z and everything will go smooth. But after having a lot more than that, I realized how differently kids are wired. Like right from the get-go, they can get put in the same home, same environment, and they're wired differently. And I've seen kids who have grown out of or been trained out of behaviors that were very difficult and very concerning as a parent, like seeing certain things in a classroom or a school setting and meeting with the teachers going, how do we address this issue? I'm nervous about the future. And then along with parenting and boundaries and consequences and help and relationship, watching kids really flourish out of that. That's been really encouraging to me. That's why I do what I do. I like to empower parents and say, don't just give up. We gotta roll up our sleeves and train these kids and teach them and invest in them.
So let's talk about the environment, though. What impact do you think that has if you dropped, if one of your kids went to a school with a lot of issues, another one went to picture the idyllic Montessori, they're like running through fields, picking up flowers, and everything's peaceful and perfect, but they have the same home and they have the same genetics. Do you think that's going to have a major impact, or do you think parents offset some of that influence in those environments?
I think it definitely has an impact, but I think there are different lessons probably gleaned from those different environments. I think a child could be put into a very difficult school with a very socioeconomically diverse population. Maybe school test scores aren't as high. And through parenting and great teachers, I think they can learn a lot about the world and about loving their neighbor as themselves and about giving back. And they might learn different things in a different environment, but obviously the challenges would be different. I talk to parents who have kids in our highest achieving schools and higher socioeconomic areas, and I talk to the opposite, and they're just learning different lessons and having different struggles to parent through. Yeah, I think it has an impact, but it could be good too. I think there's
Yeah,
part.
and I went to a private high school, not the whole time, but for a portion, and then I went to a giant state school in the Bay Area that was just so different and wild, and I just learned different things in those environments. Like one of them I really worked on myself, and then there was one where it was much more about being with a more diverse community and learning from others. I think there's just different lessons you can learn. But you brought up something I want to stick on for a second. So I have lots of friends. I don't have children myself, but I have lots of friends with kids. Some of them are religious, some of them are not. And in your book, which we're going to get to in a second, there's a lot of emphasis on the importance of moral teaching and religion. But some people could interpret that as, do you need that to be a good parent? And I don't think so. And I would assume you don't think so either. But like, help me with this a little bit. Is there something that you think kids are losing if they don't have religion as part of their upbringing?
So, I guess I would say for me that my faith is the most important thing to me, and passing that on to my kids is massive. But I know that's not true for everyone. I know all parents, or I would assume all parents, or most of them at least, have at least a moral compass or some type of idea of right and wrong they want to impart for their kids. And that kind of goes back to why I wrote the book that I wrote, Mothering Boys, that just came out this week. And that's because what I have been seeing, and especially with this is my second book. My first book, Digital Detox, really went into, and I did a ton of research about just how much time our kids are spending on their devices and how, whether you're a person of faith or not, kids today are not getting taught the way that we grew up with our parents informing our worldviews and our parents teaching us right and wrong. And so the things kids are being exposed to online, and that what they're not being exposed to from their parents, it's just completely altering how they're growing up. And most parents would say, Christian or not, that they don't like that they want to influence and teach their kids about what they know about the world and what is true and what is right. So that's really, and I do, as you mentioned, really zoom in on the Christian parent just because that's where my
Yeah, you're
perspective is.
operating where you operate. So we're going to jump into my favorite section, which is called overrated versus underrated. I'm going to throw a bunch of things at you. You tell me whether you think they're overrated or underrated and why. Feel free to pass on any of these if I wander into taboo topics. We'll
Okay.
start with the one that you already mentioned, gentle parenting. Do you think that's over or underrated?
Overrated.
Okay, why?
I guess we'd have to define the terms, but gentle parenting is that style of parenting in my mind, as I define it, as the don't tell your kids no, and
Permissive
raise.
parenting, they're
Yeah,
in that genre.
exactly. It's not
Yeah.
helping the kids.
Okay, next one. Me and Ed's Pizza.
Ooh. Underrated.
Okay, you like it. Why?
I love it. It's great. They have two different types of veggie. They've got the valley veggie and the classic veggie or the garden veggie. I don't remember. And they're both great depending on your mood. I think it's delish.
Next one, and I've just recently learned this term, lighthouse parenting.
I don't, what is that?
So that's where the parent is a lighthouse where they're like a strong center moral, like stationary object that points in directions, but all the kids are little boats and they have to make their own way to shore. But you're there as a guiding light. Do you like that concept?
I think if your kid is in their late teens, that's a great concept. I think when the, before they're like 13, you got to be more all hands on deck. You need like some kind of, you're tugging them along, like a little more tugboating.
Yeah, so tugboat and then you transition to lighthouse. Got it.
You
So
go.
it's
Yeah.
maybe stage dependent.
Yeah.
Okay. Next one, Bluey.
Oh, I haven't seen Bluey. I'm sorry. I
Okay.
don't know.
Okay. Next one, screen time restrictions.
Ooh, underrated.
Okay. So I like what, like your vision, like your kid has an iPad. How much should they be on it a day?
I don't think kids should be on iPads.
Okay. So no screen time? Is it just, are you just blackout?
So, I let me, okay, to rabbit hole us for a moment.
Yeah,
Sorry.
fire away.
Okay, so I gave my kids all the screens when they were little. My first couple kids, they got all of them. I had an iPad holder for the back of my seat when I was driving so they could be entertained. And they were dysregulated all the time, and I didn't know that's what was causing it. And then I took them all away. And it was like flipping a switch. My kids were more creative. They paid better attention. They regulated better. I lived the before and after. And I don't think young kids should have iPads. I don't think they should have interactive video gaming. I think not until they're older. And I think it should be treated like dessert rather than a main course.
Is high school the appropriate time that you'd introduce it or earlier?
I think earlier than high school is fine. Like my upper elementary school kids, I want them, I'm fine with them playing video games with their friends, like on the weekends for a couple hours. We don't do video games during the week. We do movie nights. I don't think you need to be completely off the grid like crazy, but I think that we need to limit it as a whole as parents way more than we do.
Okay, next one. Club sports or travel sports. Lots of, it's such a big thing in the area. What do you think?
I think overrated with an asterisk.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay.
I want to hear about the
Okay.
asterisk. Yeah.
I think there are families and kids for whom that is a perfect fit, but I think that as a whole, we spend too much of our time dragging our families around and centering our lives around sports. And the data shows it's burning out kids in the sports that we want them to grow to love and excel in anyway. Down a notch. Yeah.
One year I was, my wife was in residency up north and I was teaching in a small school in Lodi and there was a family there, a softball family, and they told me that 3 of the 4 weekends a month they would drive from Lodi to Los Angeles so she could play club softball. They would rent hotel rooms, the whole thing, and they're what they said to me was that it's really important for her to get a scholarship. And so in my head, my brain opened a spreadsheet and I was like, how much is that gas? How much are those hotel rooms? How much are the club sports fees? How much is your time worth? What are the opportunity costs of this? What are you missing out on going to church, seeing friends? It just felt like it felt a little like brainwashing to me, like when I was talking to them, because I was just like, how is this worth it? But to them, it was. And so I couldn't understand.
Yeah, I completely hear you. I have some friends who it's like great. Their family loves it, their kid loves it. It's their community, and that's great for them. But I do think that we are wise to evaluate, is this taking up too much of our time? Are we not connecting as a family? Are we spending more on college tuition, traveling than the then pencils out. Yeah, I agree.
Okay, next one. Disney Plus.
Ooh.
Do you think parents need this? It's like the thing, right? It's like the thing that you have to have.
I don't know that they need it. I guess I would say overrated. I don't think it's a need. Honestly, I wish we could go back to television and channels,
Like
cable. Like,
linear cable? Why?
wouldn't that be nice? Because it's we had the system beat when we had it all set up and we got TiVo. You remember
Yeah.
that?
Yeah, and I guess you're right because like for me, I would come home from school and if I miss that time slot where my show is on, I'd be like, damn it, now I gotta wait like 2 weeks or like I like there was a built-in boundary because the show ends at 4:30 and so I can't keep watching. Whereas if it's on demand, you can have it any time of day.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and that's the issue. And for parents too, it's the digital babysitter sometimes. So we just let the kids go because we know it gives us a break or even an opportunity to get stuff done. But it's the opportunity cost thing. And I really hate the paying for every single streaming service under the sun.
It's the worst. All right, just a few more on overrated versus underrated. Themed family Halloween costumes.
Oh, underrated.
You
I
like
wish I
it?
had it together enough to plan those. You got to start in August and
It
I'm more of
seems like
a
it'd take a lot of work to get everyone on the same page, get all the matching costumes.
Yeah, I'm more like a it's Halloween after school or the day before. I'm like, "Pull out the dress up bin. What do you guys want to wear?" But I really admire those families that can pull it off. I think it's super cool and fun.
Do you think raising kids with pets is important?
Absolutely.
Okay. I was talking to a friend who's they've got two kids and don't have any pets, and I was saying pushing them to get a puppy or something, and they're like, no, it's a lot of work. And I'm like, I'm sure there's some value there.
Oh, yeah. I actually talk about this in my book. It's such a great way for kids to see that they have responsibilities. And part of that is like getting up and doing something you don't really want to do because someone else depends on you, or you just got to do it. And as I mentioned, they're just on their devices all the time. So they're like in these little cocoons of comfort, and it's good for them to get jarred out of that by responsibility. So I think pets are great.
Yeah. Let's jump into your book, Mothering Boys, which I enjoyed reading quite a bit. And this is something that I think about a lot. My first question, and I've heard a lot of theories, and I'm curious yours. Why are boys so lonely today?
Yeah, it's so sad. Two-thirds of young men say no one really knows me, which I think is really sad. I think boys are spending, I think tween and teen boys are spending 8 hours a day on video games or YouTube or digital entertainment. And so they're not having community and they're not having back and forth conversation and relationship. And they're just not. They're opting out of dating, they're opting out of all of these things. And they're lonelier for that reason. So it's really sad. And I think that moms have a huge opportunity to get in there, especially when their boys are young. Because our brains do, they like go through this pruning period when kids are like 4 and 5, and then again when they're in their young teens. And whatever you don't use, you lose it. So if our kids are gaming nonstop, they're going to get really good at those first person shooter games or whatever. But if they're riding bikes with a friend or like building a fort and working collaboratively, they're going to get better at that. And it's so important to teach our kids how to have good, especially our boys.
Yeah,
Can I say
I
one more
was,
thing about, oh, sorry, go ahead.
yeah, I was just gonna say I'm pre-cell phone era when I grew up, and so we were running around. There was dirt clods, there was sticks, there was probably a few more injuries than the kids today might have, but good injuries because they teach you about don't touch the pan when it's hot, don't jump off the ledge if the whatever is not close enough. So you learn some valuable lessons. But anyway, continue with what you were saying.
No, you're so right. I was going to say Harvard. Have you heard of the Harvard study?
The track the people throughout life or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a great one.
And they, over decades, wanted to predict what's the biggest indicator of future longevity and health and happiness. And it wasn't cholesterol or exercise or income, it was quality of relationships. So the people, no matter how much money they made or where they lived, it was the people who had the best relationships at 50 live the longest and we're the happiest. It's critical that we help our boys learn how to have good relationships.
One of the things I think about a lot is, and I've worked with high school students for a long time, teaching this kind of balance between vulnerability and strength, because often those things can be at odds with each other. How do you think about teaching both of those at the same time?
Ooh, I think that's so important, and I completely agree. I actually have a couple of chapters in my book about this. Like, emotional durability is so important to teach our kids. but so is tenderness, especially for our boys. And I think for a long time, boys were told to stuff all those emotions, that real men don't show that. And that's too bad, because as a Christian, I look to Jesus, who wept, and he cried. He wept when his friend died, when Lazarus died, even though he knew he was about to bring him back to life. So he cried with people and walked with people, and yet he was so incredibly strong, like the pinnacle of strength. I think those character traits should go together, and I think that's a beautiful thing. So I think those are best taught again through relationship and through example. I think as moms, we can show our kids great examples of people living this out in our world and teaching them that it's okay. And not to, what was the word you used to describe it? It was strength and not
And
ability.
vulnerability.
Vulnerability. Yeah. Maybe that there's a place to be vulnerable. Like, you don't need to share everything with everyone, but to have people that you can share things with. And as moms, when our boys are little, when our kids are little, we're that person for them. So when we can reflect that safety and trust to them, that's actually transferable as they get older and they have friends and they're trusting those friends and being vulnerable, or even as they get married one day and trusting their wife and being vulnerable, that's huge.
So in another life, I went to seminary and I took a number of classes. I've always liked languages, so I took a lot of Hebrew and Greek and Latin and things. And I took this class from this Old Testament professor, and he had a spies book for the class. And the title of the book was Men Behaving Badly. And it basically tracks all these men in the Old Testament that just made error after error. And Christian scriptures, Hebrew Bible, Old Testament, they're complicated to use as, at least in terms of modeling yourself after characters. It can be a little challenging. But you do have sections where you talk about lessons we can learn. So how do you use biblical men in that way in your book? Describe your process.
That's a great question. Yeah, because to me, when I look at the Bible, I see a ton of people blowing it repeatedly, and God using their mistakes still in a redemptive way. So yeah, I think it goes down to, is their character behavior descriptive? Is it describing someone who blew it, or is it prescriptive, something we can take and use and chew on and emulate? And I think that we find lots of examples of good masculinity in the Bible. I look at Noah, who, in obedience to God, protected his family and provided for his family when, in obedience to God, when the people around him were probably, they thought he was crazy, and he was faithful in that, but he also blew it after the flood, too. I look at Boaz, this wealthy guy who shared his money, what he had, with widows. And I look at David, who, as a young boy, came out really bravely and was just like, I'm going to do this for God. I'm going to beat this guy if God wills it, beat Goliath. He also blew it, obviously, taking Bathsheba when she did not belong to him, and treating her like property. But I think when you hold up the way these men acted, along with what God's word tells us to do, what the Bible says, what God's commands are, it helps you parse out, oh yeah, do this and don't do this. Those were some examples I gleaned. Even Joseph in the Old Testament, he would brag to his brothers. He seemed like a pretty good guy, but he was a little tone deaf. He'd like brag to his brothers about, oh, I'm dad's favorite. You're like, that's
Yeah.
actually super annoying, Joseph. Like, why'd you do that? And then they sell him into slavery. But at the end of his story, it goes really horribly, that God actually used all of those things in a good way. So anyway, I
I
think
am pretty convinced Joseph was hitting on Potiphar's wife. I think, we're only getting one side. We don't get Potiphar's wife's side of the story, so maybe we need to check that out
that's
because
funny. We'll have to ask Indy.
he was on the come up. Let me ask you this. Someone might pick up your book and read it, and the ship has already sailed for them in terms of their kid has a phone, they have video games in their room, maybe they've dipped into porn on their phone because they have unrestricted access. There's like large bags of Takis in the pantry. There's just like I'm a survival parent and I just want my kid to just leave me be, or like I just want my kid to just have easy things because our life is difficult, or whatever it is. There's always rationalizations for it. But then they read your book and they're like, I want to jump in and start this course correction mid-flight. Like, how do you think about that? Because I'm imagining that there's some parents that'll like preparing for being a like a parent to a boy, and then there's some that are in the middle of it and it's a mess right now. Do you have recommendations for those people that are like in the mess?
Yeah, I think for our older boys especially, I think they're smarter than we realize, and they're more receptive to true information than we necessarily think. So I have found, like, even with my teenagers, my oldest is 15 and a half, and I have a 14-year-old too, but sharing information about, let's just take digital entertainment, for example, like sharing with them some of the data, like, wow, did you know that it's correlated to all these attention problems and mental health problems, and sharing truth and newspaper articles or tidbits or whatever. Like, our kids are pretty smart and reasonable. So I think it helps to bring them in on the why.
And I'll attest to that. Like when I would share stuff when I was still a classroom teacher, I would share things and then they would give me that kind of like lazy eye look. But then 2 months later, I'd be like, you remember when you said that one thing? And I was like, I'm like, you heard that? Like you were half texting and you were, your mouth was full of Cheetos, but you retained that? And they said, yes. And I'd be like, really? Fascinating. Okay. I'm glad that's in there. So I think the lack of stimuli or response might lead us to think they're not getting it, but I think they are. And that kind of leads to my next topic, which was conversation. This is another big issue that I see with kids these days. I struggle to have a conversation with a lot of them. And I think there's probably COVID reasons, there's probably phone reasons, there's probably their parents maybe are at home on their phones, not communicating regularly. Maybe they're not doing family dinner or whatever it is. How would you, without sounding pedantic, because kids can read that kind of condescension. Oh, I want to teach you how to talk. Like, how do you think about that?
I think the more organic, the better. I think I would tell parents, if I was just talking to a mom or a dad, I would say just emphasize the importance of these back and forth conversations. Harvard did a study about serve and return interactions, they call it, where kids' brains and connection is built through this serve. You ask them a question, they return, and it's this back and forth conversation that builds the brain and develops connection. They also did a study a while ago. This was super interesting. There's a book called 30 Million Words, and it says that the achievement gap is pretty much due to the fact that some kids get like 30 million words less from their primary caregiver by the time they're three than others. And so it's the number of words they hear when they're little, that back and forth chit chat that really builds their vocabularies and their ability to connect. There's a lot of research to support the importance of it. But then I would say, on a practical level, for parents, it's so simple. Go for a walk, ask their kid about their day, ask them follow-up questions, get in on their level. And I think one of the sweetest conversations I had with my son a couple years ago, I asked him a question about a video game he was playing, and his eyes lit up and he started telling me about, like, all about it. And so I asked a follow-up question, and again, like, he was going on and on and getting on their level and in their world. One of my kiddos, one of my sons, it's like all about Pokemon. And I'm like, I don't necessarily, like, personally care about Pokemon. Like, I don't
What?
know. But it helps. And also
Yeah. And having
telling,
genuine curiosity because they know when you're
yeah,
pandering. They
that's
absolutely
so
know when you're
true.
pandering. And so just, but that requires you to actually step outside of here's my to-do list, here's my calendar. I just need you to shut up and eat so we can get you to bed so I can get to the email that I need to send to my boss. Like you actually, it seems like you just have to stop and just say, okay, whatever you're
Yeah.
doing is the most important thing in the world, and I am right here.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's imagine for a second. Jerry Dyer calls you and he says, Molly, I really need a parenting czar of the city. I'm going to give you like 2% of our city budget, and I just want you to help parents in the city in any way you can. What would you do?
Oh man, that's so exciting.
I don't know if he's going to call it, but he might.
Yeah.
You never know.
That would be awesome. I think I would do a lot of, oh my gosh, you've got all of my brain is like all the
Like
gears are
after
turning right
school
now.
programs, more like parenting
So
workshops. What would it be?
I think a lot of parenting, equipping, and teaching about just the impact of social media and digital technology on our kids. I think a lot of, like, parent informing. And then lots of opportunities for families to get together and just hang out and talk to each other. I think community building would be huge. We really wither when we're isolated. But when we come together, and unfortunately, honestly, the effects of COVID, I think you're still seeing it just with people not as invested in community. They've actually done studies that, like secular studies, that show people who are the most regularly engaged in a church service, like weekly, are the happiest and have like really positive mental health. That's not true for people who are like just nominal or withdrawn or whatever, but we need community. So, yeah, I think that would be huge. I think just bringing people together somehow, and then books are huge, like getting great books into the hands of our kids, not the,
Because
not
you
like,
meet those parents that are isolated and then feel so overwhelmed, and they don't have people that they can, like you said before, someone that's like on the roller coaster with you and be like, oh, yeah, this is where the dip comes. And you're like, oh, that's helpful to know. And so it seems like isolation's a big issue with parents.
And it's really a perfect storm because, like you mentioned, it's the isolation that parents feel in conjunction with this like voyeurism online of watching other families that look like everything's perfect all the time. It makes you feel more isolated. But the reality is no one's perfect, and everyone has struggles, and parenting has difficult seasons and difficult things for every family, and we're better together.
Another area where kids are siloed, and I see this a lot in Fresno, there, you have this balance of, I want to put my kids in the best program and school possible, but I also want them to see the diversity of human life, particularly if you're raising a kid with Christian values. There's quite a bit in there about engaging with those who are different, in poverty, and a lot of things. How do you balance wanting to get the best for your kid, but also not siloing your kid in a circle where they have no sense of diversity or difference or other ways of life?
That is a great question. And one of the things, when my husband and I became foster parents, we had some people saying to us, what if it like hurts your kids, or what if your kids get less attention, or what if you bring in a foster child into your home? And we were looking at each other saying, gosh, I think the bigger danger is, what if our kids get out into the real world one day and see, oh my gosh, there's been all this need out here the whole time, and all these kids who need homes, and my parents, professing Christians, never did anything about it. That's the real danger to me. So I think it's hugely important, especially if you're a person of faith, for your kids to see, and we live in a great place for that, honestly. Like this, where we live, there's so much affluence, and there are so many people struggling. A lot of opportunities for families to serve and get involved. And our local churches do a phenomenal job. My brother's actually the pastor at City Church, that's at City Center, and they do such great work out there. It's off of, oh my gosh, I'm trying to remember. It's like Blackstone and kind of Ashland area. But there's so much need in our community. Yeah, I would just encourage parents, local parents, to ask your local church how to serve and get involved, and let your kids see, just not everyone lives the same way you do. There are always ways to get involved, and I think that's really why we're put on this earth, is to help other people. So I think that's critical.
I ask every guest this question, and I like people to think about what they've chosen to do with their life, how that affects the way they see a place like Fresno. So, like through the work you're doing, writing books, trying to support parents in this complicated and difficult journey, like how does that affect the way Fresno, Clovis, this area?
I think I would say there are just so many incredible families here. I grew up in Southern California too, actually, and I went to school up in Northern California, and my husband's from here. That's why we live here. I remember when I came to
I know
visit.
nothing about that.
Okay.
No, I yeah, that's exactly why I'm here too.
Oh, really? Your wife is
Yes.
from here? Okay. Yeah, and if you're from Southern California, you have a chip on your shoulder about Fresno, but everyone who's like that has never been here. And then once you come here, you're like, wow, this is like a really great place to live. The people are wonderful. It's beautiful. The schools are great. And I think that's what I've seen the more I research, and the more work I've done, and the more involved I get in sports or activities or my kids' schools. I see, gosh, this valley has a tremendous, just the people are the best part of our community. Like we have so many talented and humble people here. There's another reason to get involved with people and to find community, because I think we have the best and brightest people here.
We always close these podcasts with book recommendations. What are a few books you'd like to recommend to listeners?
Ooh, that's a good one. A really good book is The Anxious Generation.
Yeah, that hype book is really, it's making waves too, which I love. It's pushing people to make decisions. It's influencing our government, parents, everything. If you haven't read
Absolutely.
it, you missed this momentous thing. You need to jump in. And it feels like there's been a number of books follow up on it, like expanding on this kind of wave a little bit. What
Yeah,
did you
yeah.
like about it?
I really liked the more recent research about it, really just got into the nitty-gritty of what the technology is doing to our kids. How one tidbit I love from it is that social media affects kids differently depending on if they're boys or girls. I think it's most harmful to boys between the ages of 14 and 15, and it's most harmful to girls between 11 and 13. We have so much access to great data and information to help us as parents make our decisions. So, yeah, that book has a lot of good stuff in it. I'm trying to think of another good one. I'm trying to pick up some old classics right now, but those are a little slower going through.
What classics are you picking up?
I just picked up Pride and Prejudice, which is great. It's like switching gears back writing from like the 1800s.
It's a perfect time because it's her 250th anniversary. I'm actually in an online like Austin book club, and we're going through the whole thing this year because it's that, which I tell people, and they're like, "Oh, you're reading Jane Austen?" I'm like, "You guys don't understand. She is sarcastic, sardonic, hilarious.
She's
She's an
hilarious, yeah.
incredibly funny writer." And I think people like, they're like, "Oh, she's fancy Danielle Steele." And I'm like, "No, you don't know what you're talking about." But any case, so to close your book, there's two books. I would recommend both of your books. So the newest one is Mothering Boys, 8 Things Your Son Needs From You Before He Turns 10. But if you need to work with your kids, if you got some cell phone addiction, digital detox, a 2-week tech reset for your kids would also be incredibly helpful. And I'm hoping that we are in a change of the tides in terms of technology, and that the information, it feels like it's like cigarettes. Like everyone smoked in the 50s and 60s, and we start to get information. And then, we're at a place where like we can say definitively these things are unhealthy if you're in an age bracket. Honestly, I think they're unhealthy for adults too, but that's a whole
Yeah,
different
it can
discussion
be
about
different. Yeah.
self-harm. So, anyway, Molly, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thanks, Jordan.
Fresno's best. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, you can support this podcast by leaving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/Fresno's Best. We'll see you next time.